behind the wheel, under the hood, and beyond with Car Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Previously on Car Stuff. No, I'm kidding. I'm sorry. Welcome to Car Stuff, everybody. I'm Ben Boland.
And I'm Scott Benjamin. Ben, today we're going to have the second half of our Formula One podcast. I'm pretty excited.
I am thrilled. Let's get right into it.
Now we're talking about like engine building and, you know, maybe what they can do with these things. Let's talk about the cost of the engines maybe just for a moment.
Oh, we have to put in that statistic too. Okay. So these amazing engines, now let's just to put this back into the Grand Prix phase, right? For some context, we said that they were doing 700 plus per race, right? 700 plus miles.
Yes.
So, on average, while a Formula One engine these days will just smoke my Monte Carlo to the ground.
I would say so.
Yeah. I'm secure in admitting that it's true. The Formula One engine is not near as durable.
No. As a matter of fact, yeah, they have some strict rules about, you know what? I think we need to go back for just one second. Just one second. And I only want to say it because of the fuel. I think we do need to talk about the fuel
leading up to this.
But the fuel is basically the same type of fuel you can buy out on the open market, really.
Yeah. And the, power boosting additives that you might be familiar with are not allowed.
Yeah. And that is why, you know, you're talking about durability and how long these things last. The only reason I think we need to mention fuel right now is because in the early days, the fuel was so corrosive and so filled with additives like benzene and alcohol and other types of fuel like jet fuel, really.
Yeah.
Extremely high octane. They would actually corrode the engine from within if you left it sitting in the engine for longer than just for the race or qualifying.
So you had to break down the engine if you wanted to save it.
Almost immediately.
You had to break it almost immediately.
Clean everything. And, you know, of course, there's some parts that are just sacrificial. You know, they have to go.
Mm-hmm.
In order to save that engine, which is a very expensive engine, as we'll find out after we talk about durability, it's developed to the point where they don't need to do that as much anymore because the fuel is, like I said, it's really surprisingly so just about like what you would find in conventional automobile gasoline.
Now they have some non-hydrocarbon compounds that are allowed in, but they're very small qualities. And you typically, if you go to a gas station, you will have a choice of three types of fuel.
Yeah.
These guys work with 50 different fuel blends, right?
50 blends. And it's for track conditions.
Mm-hmm.
It's for weather conditions. It's for, exactly the altitudes that they're at. It's really incredible. I mean, we're talking humidity levels, things like that.
Yeah.
50 different blends of fuel. That to me would be a nightmare job trying to figure out what blend of fuel to use at what race on what day. You're watching the weather forecast. You're watching, you know, the barometric pressure. You're watching everything.
Mm-hmm.
Humidity levels, trying to figure out what fuel to use.
And let's keep in mind that these are only the 50 blends that have been submitted and approved by the FIA.
Yeah, that's right.
So God knows how many different blends were submitted.
And you know that they're tested. So, you know, they're sampled and tested. The FIA tests them and make sure that you're not running into illegal fuel. And they use a lot of fuel, Ben.
During a single season, one team would use around 200,000 liters. And that's not with the best MPH. Formula One car, one of the reasons you wouldn't want to make it a daily driver, it gets about 4 miles to the gallon.
Yeah, and for, us U.S. listeners here, that equates to about 52,834 gallons of fuel in one season.
Now, in their defense, Scott, that is also for testing. It's not just for racing.
Okay, Ben. Okay. Now you mentioned durability, and I didn't mean to cut you off with this fuel thing, but the fuel plays so heavily in durability on these things.
Right.
Or it did. Mm-hmm. Now it's a little bit less of a factor, and the FIA has made some adjustments for that, right?
Yes. We want the one stat that I'm really excited about that I want to drop on us before we get to some more of the stuff about the engine here is that these engines need to be rebuilt after about 500 miles on average.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's maybe two races, really.
It's maybe.
Maybe. I would think that it's probably every race,
really. I mean, that mile counter factors into testing.
However, when you're talking about engines, we're not saying it's a new engine. They can't just, you know, swap it out and put in a new one, because there are also rules that tell you that state how many races the teams are allowed to use per season and per groups. Maybe I'm not saying it the right way. How many races these engines have to last is probably the best way.
Right. And I think the way the rule is written is, as you said, engines. New engines per season, or total number of engines.
So it's like you may be allowed one engine per two race weekends. So race weekends, meaning that qualifying, practice, all that, you know, has to be done on one engine for two race weekends. Now that doesn't seem like a whole lot. But you know, when you consider that there are 19 races in the 2013 season, that means that the teams then are limited to, like, maybe say 8 engines per season. Mm-hmm. Now, 8 engines, that's a lot. And, you know, they have the same thing for gearboxes. So there's like, each gearbox has to last for something like 5 consecutive races.
Yeah.
So, you know, you need to rebuild that in order to make that work for 5 races. And that's a lot of races, really, because, you know, they put up with a whole lot. Now, 8 engines, Ben, that's got to be expensive.
How expensive is that, Scott?
I'll tell you how expensive this has been. Engines for the team overall, about 50% of their entire operating budget is spent on engines alone.
And so you guys are going to hear some numbers right now, and we want you to remember that that's half of the operating cost.
And I want to tell you that the numbers that I have are from a long time ago. These numbers that popped up, because I haven't found any current stats on this that are real concrete. So
yeah, it can be tough to find some of the current info. There's a little bit of secrecy around.
So imagine this. 8 years ago, Ben.
Okay.
This is from 8 years ago. So yeah. it's not new data, really. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's old data. When the big series players were Honda, Toyota, McLaren, Mercedes, and Ferrari. Those four teams, each one of those teams spent approximately $200 million on engines alone in that year alone.
And that's an average of 50% of their cost.
That's 50% of their budget. So, exactly. And then a smaller team like Renault, you can kind of break this down. They spent about $125 million that season. Mm-hmm. And Cosworth spent about $15 million for that season just on engines. Now that's incredible. That's enough right there to bankrupt the smaller teams.
Right. And you can tell because, the race-wide average in 2007 for the expense of an operating season, mm-hmm, was around $120 million, and that gives us a really good sense of how large the variation here is in cost. I mean, if you just look at Honda over near the top and you look at Cosworth near the bottom, I mean, this is not something that you can do in your garage.
Okay, I just thought of something.
Unless you're Jay Leno.
Now, we mentioned Honda, Ferrari, you know, those makers. The amounts that they're spending now we know that teams spend billions of dollars now.
Yes.
This was 2006, and, you know, if that's 50% of their budget, that means that, you know, those giant teams, even like Ferrari, were spending about $400 million at that time on Formula One in that year. You know, if you take that now to say that, you know, like there's, well, billions spent, you can extrapolate from that they're spending, you know, $500 million, $600 mm-hmm. million, dollars, maybe $600 or $700 million on engines alone for their race series.
And I would argue, now a lot of people who are maybe not as big of a fan of F1 as you and I are, Scott, a lot of people might be saying, what a waste of money, what a boondoggle. I object, and I want to take a moment to defend Formula One by saying...
Oh, look, I'd like to hear this. Go ahead.
Okay, yeah, here's why. Because this is not just some sort of promotional thing for Ferrari, you know? They're not just blowing $700 million for fun.
No.
For poops and giggles, if I want to keep it clean for the radio.
I think you should.
But what they are doing is driving innovation and research. If you think about it, behind the whole consumer-pleasing and fan-pleasing stuff about the race, they're making some leaps and bounds in terms of research for their future vehicles.
You know what's cool about a team like, you know, Ferrari or McLaren or anything like that? Because, you know, they also make, you know, like world supercars also.
Yeah.
Something that is developed in Formula One can go almost immediately into their, you know, their supercars.
Their high-end cars.
In their very, very high-end cars. and their customers benefit from it, you know, that season or, mm-hmm. you know, just after that season. So, you know, the rest of us, you know, that we have to wait for it to trickle down to our, you know, our Honda or our Toyota or whatever, in some form. Ferrari users may be able to benefit from something immediately, like let's say paddle shifters, yeah. which is one thing that, you know, just quickly comes to mind, paddle shifters.
And paddle shifters are on a steering wheel, and it's a way to shift gears without having to rely on the typical foot operation.
Yeah, well, without having to remove one hand from the wheel in order to shift mm-hmm. as well. Because, you know, looking back at that, you know, the Grand Prix images and even, you know, Formula One images from, you know, as late as the, well, 1990s even. Anything prior to that, you know, you're seeing people that, you know, have to let go of the wheel with one hand and reach down into the side pocket and shift and then put their hand back up on
yeah,
the wheel.
Yeah, and you're right. The primary advantage there is keeping the hands on the wheel. Sorry, I misspoke.
One more quick sidebar. Yeah. Fast, I promise, because we're getting near the end here. That footage I was telling you about, Juan Manuel Fangio driving around in Italy, you know, they've got this camera obviously strapped to the front of the car facing back at him driving. As he leaves the pits, and I have no idea how fast he's going, I'm assuming extremely fast, he takes his hands, both of them, off of the wheel as he's at speed. You know, he's going straight, of course. Both hands off the wheel, adjusts his goggles, fits the helmet on a little bit tighter, hands back on the wheel. You would never, ever, ever see that in current competition. And well, it just struck me as so odd.
Let's talk about first, I hate to say it, we have gone this far without mentioning the average speeds, Scott.
Oh, okay.
What are the average speeds?
Well, I don't know about average speeds. You have average speeds information?
I want to hear some of the.
I've got a speed stat that may really shock you.
There we go.
How about that?
That's exactly
how about a 0-60 time, Ben? Which, really, I don't know. I mean, I guess it has a lot to do with the sport because they do race from a standing start. They don't have mm-hmm. like a flying start like a lot of other series do. A 0-60 time for a good launch, right around 2 seconds, Ben. 2 seconds, 0-60. Now ponder that for just a moment because, you know, the times that are quoted are somewhere around 2.1 to 2.5. That's kind of common. But times as low as 1.6, 0-60 have been recorded. Now that's like extremely fast, motorcycle fast, you know, like, even, you know, drag car type fast. Mm-hmm. And that's, but the problem is the, you know, the 2 seconds is with no launch control or no traction control rather. And, you know, due to the fact that, you know, traction control is one of the outlawed or one of the banned things recently.
Yeah.
That's one of the things that you don't really see, but you know, 2 seconds, that's still incredibly quick. And they say that better times or better speeds are even possible. So, you know, watch for some advancements in that. I think that may come back.
I think especially with the addition of turbos.
Yeah.
Now that turbos are no longer pariahs.
Did you have more to say about speed? Because I think I've got a little bit I can add to this, but we've talked about, you know, Formula E and its top speed and, you know, mm-hmm. I wasn't too impressed with that.
Yeah.
Well, the top, Formula One speed ever recorded was done on like at the private test track or something. And it was like 268 miles an hour or something crazy mm-hmm. like that. That's mm-hmm. amazing. And, you know, during the race, you know, the way the courses are set up, they don't really go flat out for a long, long period of time like you would on an oval or, you know, high speed oval or any of the, you know, the big super tracks like we see here in the States a lot, where NASCAR and IndyCar race. But, you know, the nature of the beast is, you know, they have a long straightaway usually at some point in this where they
right.
do achieve the top speed and it's really quick. They get up to, you know, like the 220 mark, something like that. Or, you know, some may be as low as 180, which is still ridiculously fast because, you know, you got to make a hard right turn at the end of that.
That's what I was waiting for because I think that's one of the important parts to remember here is that the difference between 268 miles per hour and 180 or 220, may befuddle some people, but it just underscores the nature of F1, which is that the governing body puts restrictions on the competitors. I mean, normally it seems weird to think, wow, they're not racing and they got 268, but
make no mistake, these are fast, fast cars. They're the top of their game, really.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if they were allowed to race on an oval, a high-speed oval.
Right, where they had those two big straightaways.
Yeah, and turns that you can pretty much go full throttle all the way through.
Yeah.
That's completely different than the courses that, you know, these Formula One racers drive on. I mean, if you look at any Formula One track, try to imagine any place in that track that you're going to be able to get the car up to 200 miles an hour. And you'll be astounded.
Without wrecking.
And you'll be astounded that they do, because these guys have incredible control. It's it's a driver's sport.
Yes. And I want to talk about just a couple more things. I'm so excited about this, Scott, that I feel like we're going to run out of time without everything we want.
You know, it always happens, and maybe it'll show up, you know, in a nuts and bolts thing, because maybe we should just mention things fast so that we get them out there and we know, like, people can see that we know about them, we're acknowledging
them. Yeah.
How about, like, the CARE system?
Okay, yes. You'll talk about the CARE system. We'll trade this off without any need for order. You're just going to hear some quick, fast Scott and Ben facts.
Sounds good.
Okay, CARE system.
Oh, you want to go me first? Okay. Yeah. All right, CARE system. There are three types. There's the battery type, there's the flywheel type, there's the hydraulic type. However, you're only going to hear about the battery type because so far, you know, it's not compulsory that they have the system initially. It's just that the teams that have opted to use the CARE system, every single one of them has used the battery type.
And what is the CARE system?
The CARE system is a kinetic energy recovery system. So it's like regenerative braking almost. Mm-hmm. In that, you know, you build up energy and you store it, and then the driver can release it with a push of a button on the steering wheel, on that incredible steering wheel.
Right. And just to recap, as you said, of the three that are there, only the battery has been used. Let's talk about the wings for a second.
Very good.
Now, those are some of my favorite things when we talk about the bodies of these cars. The wings first appeared in the 1960s. So they operate like airplane wings, but in reverse. So airplane wings create lift, but wings on a Formula One car produce downforce. This holds the car onto the track. And this gets kind of tricky because these cars have to be built with a monocoque design to withstand tremendous downforce.
That is going to tie into something that I saw later on. We're going to have just a real brief Stuff Scott sees, and that's the monocoque design is going to tie into that. There's no pace car in the series. There's what they call a safety car, and that's used for caution periods. But like I said, they do a standing start. You'll see that, and that's a very dramatic moment, by the way, when they're all lined up on the grid and then the lights drop, and it's amazing. It's really cool to watch, and sometimes there's a little bit of chaos that goes on there. But Mercedes-Benz has been supplying the safety car since 1996, and the current model is an SLS AMG 6.3-liter V8, which has 571 horsepower. It's an incredible car.
So that car itself is pretty mean,
it's,
huh?
It's awesome. Really mean. Yeah, it's a great car. It would be fun to drive.
Okay, so let's go to the steering wheel. I want people to check out How Formula One Works, an article on HowStuffWorks.com by William Harris, I think, has an excellent diagram of the Formula One steering wheel. This thing is huge, Scott. It doesn't just have paddle shifters. Mm-hmm. It has everything. I'm just going to name some of the stuff you'll see. You'll see a display. You'll see a speed limiter, radio, driver drinking pump, multifunction dials, traction control when it was allowed, oil pump, fuel hatch, gear shift, clutch paddle. There's so much here that it reminds me of one of the when video game controllers started becoming bigger and bigger.
Yeah, overly complex.
It's overly complex. You can't just hop in these things. That's the point we're trying to make.
But the thing is, those are refined down to just what they need, and look how complicated that is. So that tells you something right there, how difficult it is to drive these cars, because they're loaded with electronics and mm-hmm. technology. These things are basically rolling test beds for any manufacturer that's in the series, and that's
right.
Exactly what they use it for, and that's why they have no problem spending $1 billion a year on these rolling test beds, because they get so much out of it.
And here's the thing, it does have to be simplified. The rules state that a driver has to be able to get out of the car within 5 seconds, and you can only remove the steering wheel. That's the only thing you can remove in that 5 seconds. So to allow for this, the steering wheel is joined with a snap-on connector.
I will tell you about that in a moment, I promise. That's okay. One of the things. All right, so two things that the series no longer has that I would like to tell you.
Oh, great, yeah.
They have no tire war. So there's no, you know, dual suppliers for tires. Pirelli is the sole provider for the series of it now. And I think Bridgestone was in the past, and, you know, they, not sole provider, but, you know, there's a back and forth between them, mm-hmm. like who had the better tire, and, you know, there's no tire war in that series. Pirelli is the only game.
And they're super soft tires.
Very, very soft. Yeah, that's right. And they're preheated in the pits so that they're ready to go when they leave. There's no refueling during the race, and that's something that's, relatively new since 2010. However, refueling was only allowed between 1994 and 2010, and they've completely removed it. So during the race, mm-hmm. you're no longer allowed to add or remove fuel. Then now that's important, because there must have been some fuel removing going on at some point for them to add that, because, you know, that may be a strategy, a weight strategy for some team.
Right. Great. And that dovetails perfectly, because let's talk about weight. Weight is huge here. There, now, Formula One, if you haven't gotten the sense of it yet, let's just say this explicitly. Formula One literally has a rule about everything. And when somebody figures out a way around the rule, then boom, there's another rule. And that's part of the game. That's how it should be played. But there is, of course, a rule for the total weight of a vehicle, counting the driver and not counting the driver. So there's ballast weight too, right?
Ballast weight that they can move around, you know, on their own. They decide when, you know, where to use it, but they have to use the exact amount, because the car with driver has to weigh a certain amount. And I think that that has been up this year. I've got a note on it somewhere and I'll have to dig it up, but, it's been increased by like, I think it's by like 2 kilograms, and that's because of the Pirelli tires. They said that the tires weigh just a little bit more. They're going to, they made an allowance for it in this case.
Okay.
So, the ballast weight then is, you know, comes into, you know, play even more. And things like the Kara system that we talked about, that weighs, I think, 35 kilograms. So, you know, the teams that opt for that, they carry 35 kilograms of Kara's and less ballast weight.
Mm-hmm.
And the other teams carry more ballast weight. So everybody is equal in weight.
So, yeah, because this also comes into some of the material science. The body of the Formula One is made of a lot of carbon fiber, dual compounds, maybe over an aluminum mesh. And this is to fight for the all-powerful weight-to-power ratio, which you and I talk about frequently. One thing, Formula One teams each have two drivers. They do not just have one driver. And these drivers are not necessarily BFFs because Formula One driver is out to beat his rivals, including the driver on the team. So this
There's been some controversy in the past, I know.
Exactly.
And, in one, you know, one teammate allowing the other one, or allowing the other one to win, or allowing the other one to block for him or her.
Yeah.
Well, or her, I guess, in some cases.
Yeah. And that's technically against the rules, but it's tough to enforce that.
That's true, because it's tough. It's really difficult to determine whether or not someone is blocking or just, being aggressive or, you know, defending their position.
And we're back, and Scott, you're killing me, because this has been a two-part podcast, and I respect your wishes about keeping this stuff Scott sees secret, but you gotta tell me.
It's time to let it out of the bag, right? All right, so here's what I've got. The other day on the way to work, this ties perfectly into our F1 podcast, and I can't believe this just works out this way a lot of times. This is 2 days ago. I saw this on the road here in Buckhead, Georgia. Driving through traffic, immediately to my right, a car zips past me in traffic, you know, heavy, heavy traffic, you know, in the morning in downtown Atlanta. Car I'd never seen on the road before, something unique, something that another one that I didn't think I would ever see. And I had to identify it when I got to work based on what I saw. I tried to remember certain characteristics. I couldn't even figure out what it was really at first. It was a gray car, a supercar.
Okay.
It was a McLaren MP4-12C.
In Atlanta.
And, this made me think of it because, you know, we're doing this F1 podcast that we had been researching already.
Mm-hmm.
And, I know that there's so much Formula One technology that's built into this McLaren.
Yeah.
And this was just like one of those moments where, like, I can't believe I'm seeing this right now. First one I've ever seen on the road. And I see it 2 days before we're recording this podcast on Formula One.
Mm-hmm.
So what a great tie-in, right?
Yeah.
And, I mean, it's an amazing, amazing car. I mean, it's like, it's got a lot of F1 style to it. But it does have this carbon monocoque design to it. It's called the carbon monocell.
Yeah.
And I found out something interesting looking it up. It's manufactured in Austria, and this monocell thing, the production, I mean, that's where everything starts. It's like a tub that the driver sits in, and then everything else is built around that tub. That's like the safety part of this thing, and that comes directly from Formula One racing. And other cars have used this. Now, the McLaren F1, the one that, you know, Jay Leno has, and, you know, you see a lot of big name celebrities own this car. It's a $1 million car. The same type of cell that they used in this thing, similar, took about 3,000 hours just to complete the cell, just to build that cell.
Wow.
I know, it's a shocking number. I mean, it's a carbon fiber tub again.
Mm-hmm.
Now the Mercedes-Benz SLR, the McLaren version, they took that down to 500 hours through advancements. And now for this McLaren MP4-12C that I saw, 4 hours.
4 hours.
They cut it down from 3,000 hours of production time to build this, just the tub part, not the car.
Yeah.
The tub part. 3,000 hours, they took it down to 4 hours in the MP4 12C.
That's astonishing.
Now, it's an expensive car. It's about $250,000. That's what it base
sure.
price. That's base price.
Sure.
But it's like a 600 horsepower, 7-speed, again, supercar. So it's an, I thought it was a cool thing to see.
Now, before we get to that last stat, I want to do one thing here. I want to read to you a tweet that our buddy Tom Holland asked us.
Okay.
Okay, so Tom asked us, why are women not competing in F1 when they're in GP2 and the Renault Formula? Is it strength or durability?
Ah, good question. We've got a pretty concise answer for you here, really. I mean, I think women are coming back into the sport, really.
Mm-hmm.
And we're seeing that in, you mentioned that there's not just one driver. There's also backup drivers,
right.
development drivers,
mm-hmm.
which test for the team because, you know, the teams are out on the road all the time, right?
Mm-hmm.
And there are some current drivers. There's some women development drivers. One of them is Susie Wolf. And then there's also Maria de Villota, or Viota, maybe. But one of them is a Williams development driver. That's Susie. And Maria, she's a test driver for, I think it's Marussia or Marussia. It's another team. I'm not sure how you pronounce it. It looks like Marussia. But there have been Formula One drivers in the past, Formula One women drivers. And now, the controversy here comes up in very recent months when Stirling Moss, he's, again, here's the guy's 83 years old. He's a driving legend. He's won a lot of races. No championships, though. I was surprised to hear that Stirling Moss never had a championship, but he had 16 Grand Prix wins. Now, recently, he infamously said that women have the strength, but not the mental aptitude to race hard wheel to wheel. That is his direct quote. Now, that, you know, provoked a lot of people into, that's a
yeah.
controversial statement.
I mean, I disagree.
I also disagree. I think that's not correct. Now, I mean, this is a guy that raced from like 51 to 61. So he's, you know,
yeah.
old school again.
Mm-hmm.
Just kind of speaks his mind when he's out there, says whatever he feels like saying. Maybe not the most politically correct thing to say, but, you know, he also was in the series when there was at least one other female driver, in the 1950s, late 1950s. There was a driver named Maria Teresa de Philippus.
Mm-hmm.
And she entered 5 times, had 3 starts, but didn't get any points in the series. In the 70s, there was Lella Lombardi, and she actually had 17 entries and 12 starts, and she earned a half a point. Now, that's important because that's the only point that's ever been won by a woman in F1 driving.
Mm-hmm.
Out of the 5 that I'll mention here, there was also a Davinia Galicia, and Desiree Wilson and Giovanni Amati. And, you know, they're tough names to pronounce. Obviously, I didn't do well with them.
I commend your effort.
But that spans from the late 50s up until the early 1990s. And, you know, I mean, we've got, so the 5 women that have mm-hmm. entered at least one race, only 2 have ever qualified to start in a race, you know, that have qualified for it. And only one of them has ever scored an official point in Formula One, which is kind of, that's a big deal, really. And then in 1976, there was an F1 race where there were 2 women entered. So they're there.
Yeah, to answer your question, Tom, there are female drivers and have been female drivers in F1. There haven't been as many as men, clearly.
Oh,
Scott. Oh, brother. We have a lot of stuff. Here we are. This is a long podcast, and we still have some things we need to talk about before we get out of here.
I know that we're going to walk out with extra things on our notepads here that we never even covered.
But we do have one big world record that we've been teasing this whole episode, and I think it's time to reward our listeners and let them know what it is.
Yeah, and I'll do it kind of quick here, in, you know, good fashion here, as you'll see, because now it's all about pit stops, okay? And
okay.
There is a new world record pit stop in Formula One, by the way. Now, formerly, these things were kind of chaotic.
Yeah, and famously fast already.
Exactly, famously fast. You're right. They're very choreographed. You know, they're what we call like millimeter precise events right now, right?
That's a great way to say it.
I mean, they're very, very precise. Now, pre-1994, remember there was no refueling, and then it was banned again in 2010. So that, you know, that led to longer pit stops, and that they still had to add this fuel, and it was something crazy. It was like 12 liters per second or something they could get in there. So it was really fast.
Mm-hmm.
But now, As of the 2010 season, pit stops are really restricted to, minor repairs on the car.
Yeah.
And tires, because they don't do any refueling during the race. So, pit stops, if you want to just get a quick thing, like the time to, you mentioned the steering wheel before.
And right.
I told you I was going to tell you, it takes 2 seconds to replace the steering wheel. That means that someone leans in, removes one, puts one on, 2 seconds. That's really quick. To change a tire, about 3 seconds. Now that's not true anymore, as I'll tell you in just a moment. Replace the nose of the car, the entire front of the car, takes about 11 seconds. But
wow.
this new record that I'm going to tell you about, Ben, this is incredible. And this is something you have to see to believe. You really do.
Okay.
You have to look this up because I can describe it. You won't even get it until you see it.
Is this the world record for fastest pit stop?
This is.
F1?
And it happened in 2013 at the Malaysian Grand Prix. And this is the Infiniti Red Bull Racing Team. Four tires, the fastest ever pit stop, all four tires, on and off, 2.5 seconds.
What?
How? No, I'm sorry, 2.05 seconds. So we're talking like almost exactly 2 seconds. Now ponder that in your mind for just a moment. And that comes from the car telemetry, which says the car's at a dead stop, the car's moving. So it's not like, someone with an inaccurate stopwatch in the pit stop saying, in the pit area saying, it's about 2 seconds. It's 2.05 seconds for the pit stop.
So robots.
Yeah, nope. that's an incredibly precise team. Now the previous record was 2.31 seconds. It was held by the McLaren team. Now that's incredibly quick as well, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And to visually see this, it's not a whole lot different, but, in fact, during this race, the Red Bull racing team says they broke that record 5 times during this race that we're talking about, where they actually broke the world record.
Yeah.
And in fact, the slowest pit stop for the team on that day was faster than the previous record.
Wow.
So if you watch this thing, I swear to you, it's like you're in imagine if you're in a parking lot and you do come to a complete stop. A lot of people roll through, but
right.
Let's say you're in a parking lot and you come to a complete stop and then you look and you go. That's how fast this entire pit stop is, and that's four tires on and off. And that's I'm looking at the picture here. It's like 15 or 16 guys over the wall or, out in the pit.
Yeah.
It's incredibly fast. You've got it. You've literally got to see it to believe it.
And speaking of seeing it to believe it, you can check it out, right, on YouTube maybe?
Oh, yeah, anywhere on YouTube you can find that. And if just search World's Fastest Pit Stop. Don't look at the McLaren one because, that's the previous record. Look for the Red Bull
2013.
Exactly, and you'll find it.
And so we hope that you guys have enjoyed our fanboy podcast on F1 racing. Please let us know what you think. You can find us on Twitter. You can drop us a line on Facebook. You can also send us an email. At
carstuff@discovery.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com. Let us know what you think. Send an email to podcast@howstuffworks.com.